Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
President Donald Trump addresses the UN General Assembly for the first time and has harsh words for North Korea. I spoke with Harvard Law Professor Jack Goldsmith and asked him about the situation we find ourselves in.
It's a very worrisome situation when you have a confrontation with a nuclear power that has been threatening and aggressive, and the President of the United States is someone who is mercurial and uninformed and doesn't tend to exercise good judgment. That is the definition of a very scary situation.
He explains why he believes the president is permanently altering some of our democratic institutions. Then, the medieval secret society, the Knights Templar, has captured the imagination of writers for years, from the legends of King Arthur to the Da Vinci Code. Historian Dan Jones separates the myth from reality and tells why their story is relevant today. First, Jack Goldsmith. He's professor of law at Harvard University, the author of the new article in The Atlantic titled, Will Donald Trump Destroy the Presidency? I caught up with him over Skype and asked him how pessimistic he was about the answer to that question.
Well, so I started off the piece by trying to be a little optimistic and saying, first of all, we've never really had a president who has ever, who's attacked institutions of government and related to government like the media as Donald Trump. And so the question I tried to answer is, what is his impact on the presidency and on those institutions? And some of those institutions have performed very well in checking him and keeping him from illegal action in certain areas. But the thing I worry about most is not so much his impact on the presidency from his violation of norms, because I think that those norm violations that he's committed, and he's committed many, I think future presidents won't follow him in that. But what I worry about is his impact on courts and the media and the bureaucracy and their norm violations, which they have engaged in response to his norm violations. And I worry that those will be harder to recover after he leaves office.
Give me an idea of just what you mean by norms.
Sure. So there's a lot of talk about norms. There are many forces that operate on the presidency. We often think about law as the main force to prevent the president from illegal action, and law gets enforced through courts. And it gets enforced inside the executive branch, and it gets enforced informally in other ways. But beyond law, there are a lot of things that the president can do that are lawful, that are legal and lawful, that he doesn't do because there are non-legal prescriptions or implicit rules that presidents tend to follow. And these rules, they tend not to engage in vicious attacks on courts, even though that's not illegal. They tend to not attack their own cabinet members, even though that's not illegal. They tend to comply with norms about conflicts of interest, even if the letter of the law doesn't require it. And so there are a lot of principles of right action that aren't actually legal rules that we call norms that really are important in restraining and guiding and legitimating the presidency.
It's so interesting that you write that many people may not realize until now the extent to which the presidency is shaped by, as you write, quote, the character, competence, and leadership skills of the person who occupies the presidency.
Yes, it's true. I mean, the framers of our Constitution created a very open-ended presidency. There are very few guideposts to what the presidency has to do. He's given a lot of very vague powers, and the presidency has grown in the last 230 or so years into this gargantuan institution, much bigger and more powerful than the framers contemplated. And yet, really the office is undefined, and so it's filled by those characteristics of the presidency. And so really there's no institution of our government that is more defined by an individual than the presidency.
Take us back to the very beginning of the presidency and talk about the Muslim ban he put in place. Donald Trump does not ignore the courts. How crucial was that moment for you?
So when Trump issued his immigration order, I mean, it wasn't on its face a Muslim ban, but many people believe that's what was motivating it. But when he issued that order, it was, you know, he actually violated many norms related to the issuance of executive orders in the sense that it was sloppily issued. It had mistakes in it. It was too broad. It wasn't vetted internally. It wasn't rolled out properly. And but he issued it, and very quickly the courts rose up and enjoined him from enforcing it. And there was a crucial moment there, late January, early February. A lot of people believed that Trump wasn't going to comply with the courts. And then in a way, there's really nothing to make Trump comply, or any president comply, with a judicial decision, because the president controls the sword, so to speak. And it's just been, and some presidents have defied or threatened to defy judicial decisions in the past. And Trump, of course, didn't have very nice things to say about the courts. And so there was a lot of people who believed and worried openly that Trump was just going to defy the courts and continue to enforce this first immigration order and then really throw us into a real constitutional crisis. But for whatever reason, we don't know the inside story yet. I think it was because he would have had massive resignations in his administration in the third week of his presidency. But for whatever reason, he complied with the judicial orders, and he's been complying ever since while fighting them through proper processes in courts.
So in one sense, he is a realist.
Well, there are many, there's a lot of counter evidence to that. But in this situation, I'm speculating. We don't know why he complied. And the moment he started complying that Saturday morning, I forget the exact date, the moment he started complying, he also started attacking the courts on his Twitter feed. So I guess he was probably a realist in deciding to comply and not to ignore because the courts. But he hasn't seemed terribly realistic in lots of other respects, so I'm not really sure.
What about his relationship with Republicans currently, Professor Goldsmith? How do you see that as an indication of whether he's a realist, whether he's a pragmatist, whether he is sensible?
That's a very tough question. It's always difficult to generalize about Trump and his political inclinations because he's so mercurial. He changes his mind so much. I mean, he's been at odds with the Republican Party and the Republican establishment since the primaries. He has continued to attack Republicans during his presidency, including senior leadership. And now he's showing indications of trying to work with Democrats on some issues. It's very hard to know how much to read into that. So I just think it's the Republican Party itself is in a very awkward position because you have a president who isn't obviously committed to a lot of the things that the party is committed to, who is and has no loyalty to the party, and yet he controls the presidency and he's necessary for the Republicans to achieve their agenda. It's worked very well on judges. I mean, there the Republican Party and the president are completely on the same page and they've worked together, and Trump's been able to get a lot of excellent conservative judges onto the courts already. But in every other respect, the relationship is fraught, I think. And I don't know how to characterize Trump's politics. I really can't do it.
And what about the Republicans themselves? Do you see them standing up in any way to President Trump?
They have actually, in ways that aren't adequately appreciated, I believe, stood up to him on at least one matter, and that is the Russia, the DNC hack, and the Russia, and Russia's involvement in the election. Not only So, you know, the president has denied that connection, and he's attacked persons and institutions who claim that the Russians, in various ways, who claim that the Russians were involved in helping him win the election, or at least in influencing the election. The Republicans, by large majorities, voted to issue very harsh sanctions against Russia, even though the president opposed it and even though it limited presidential power. Both the House and especially the Senate Intelligence Committees are conducting what appear to be very robust investigations into the DNC hack. And importantly, when Trump was threatening to fire Mueller and Sessions, or seeming to threaten to fire Mueller, the special counsel, or Sessions, the attorney general, senior members in the Senate warned him against doing so and threatened him against doing so. So in that respect, I believe that the Republicans are standing up to Trump in an appropriate way. In other respects, they're not. I mean, in other respects where politics are more salient, I think that they're in this very awkward dance of trying to work with him.
You question President Trump's, quote, emotional intelligence. Give us an example of what you mean.
Emotional intelligence is your ability to exercise self-control in a way that is constructive for your ends, for what you're trying to achieve. And so many times, I mean, it happens every day, Trump blurts things out because he's thin-skinned, or because he's has some resentment, or because he's cruel. And he has very little self-control and extremely little self-discipline. And so he's constantly engaging in self-defeating actions that I think are harmful to him and his agenda, simply because he can't control himself.
But do you regard that as a lack of emotional intelligence, or is it simply his personality, his position as head of a very large corporation in which he could have his way without anyone questioning him? He's just in the habit of having his way.
Wait, I think that's right, but I think that informs what his emotional intelligence is. He's been in the business. For his whole life, he's gotten his way. He's never really had to, as far as I can tell, answer to others or be accountable to others within his organization. And now he's running a giant organization, and he doesn't like accountability. He doesn't like second guessing. He doesn't like when people don't listen to him. He doesn't like when things are reported in a way he doesn't like. And but how he deals with those things are, for whatever reason, maybe due to past patterns, maybe due to the way he was raised, I don't know, personality traits, how he deals with those challenges is informed by his emotional intelligence, his ability to control his emotions, his ability to have self-discipline in his public utterances. And he's just terrible at that.
But at the same time, you say he's far less hypocritical than past presidents. I find that fascinating.
Well, hypocrisy is usually given a bad name. And I only had a paragraph to make this point in the piece, so it's a little bit compressed. Hypocrisy is given a bad name, and at many times, especially in personal relations, hypocrisy is a vice, I believe. But hypocrisy, in a way, it's a way of what I mean by hypocrisy is that successful leaders, especially in pluralistic democracies with many audiences that they have to bridge, whose interests they have to bridge, there are better and worse ways of speaking in public. And presidents tend to put, when they're acting in a self-interested way or when they're pushing a certain agenda, they tend to wrap that agenda in principle or other regarding ideas, rather than just seeming crassly self-interested and self-promoting. And Trump is not hypocritical in that way. He doesn't sugarcoat a lot of his stuff. He just says whatever crass thing he's thinking. He doesn't attempt to sugarcoat. So when I say he's not hypocritical, I mean he doesn't, to put it simply, he doesn't sugarcoat when he's acting in these terrible ways. He doesn't even try.
And you think that actually hypocrisy is an underappreciated virtue?
Well, you know, President Obama was actually a master at this, and I don't mean hypocrisy in a bad sense. He was very good in his orations at, when he was pushing a certain agenda, in wrapping those agendas in broader principles that weren't really what was necessarily what was motivating or what he was trying to achieve, but putting it in a more palatable way that in a way tamps down on divisiveness in society. And one of the things about Trump's approach of just being sort of openly crass is that it tends to promote divisiveness, I think.
Now, what about the other institutions, the courts, the media? They're supposed to be checking the presidency. What kind of a job do you think they're doing?
So I think they're both doing a good job and going too far. And let me explain what I mean by that. The press and the courts and civil society have done a very good job in checking Trump from legal excess. But one of Trump's characteristics is that he induces other people in his norm breaking and in his attack on people, his unprecedented kind of vicious attacks on the media and courts and even the institutions of his own executive branch and in Congress. He tends to cause the institutions he's attacking to act like him and to break norms. The example I used to illustrate this was Marco Rubio, who Trump attacked his little Marco and was making fun of him and belittling him. And then Rubio was finally provoked to act like Trump, talking about the size of his hands, questioning his manliness and the like. And it was a disastrous response for Rubio and ended up basically ending his campaign. And the thing I worry about is that the institutions that Trump is attacking are themselves going further than they normally would and in violating norms that have basically applied to them as well.
Give me an example as regards the media.
So the media, this is very hard to prove, but I can give you some examples. So the media, there's never been anything close to the percentage and rate of negative stories from the national media about a president early in the presidency as there was about Donald Trump. Now, some people say, well, that's because Trump is such a terrible person and independent media will be more aggressive against him. And there's something to that. Maybe it's true. But as Bob Woodward said, and I quoted him in the piece, a lot of the media are drinking or binge drinking the anti-Trump Kool-Aid. And you really see to a much greater degree in the past in mainstream publications, you see a lot more opinion interspersed with fact. I'm not saying every journalist, I'm not saying every story, certainly. I'm just talking about it in general. You see more opinion being put into factual stories. You see many more negative stories about the presidency. You see mainstream journalists on Twitter, especially in social media, really stepping outside of their so-called independent journalistic role and engaging in politics and letting their political views to be known, and that in itself informs how their stories are read. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, the media is less popular than Donald Trump. And it's been one of his more successful tactics has been to attack the media.
But, you know, Professor Goldsmith, going back to the very beginning of the Trump presidency, when he claimed that more people than ever had come out to vote for him, more people were at his inauguration than had ever been, how should the media have reacted except to point out that those were falsehoods?
Oh, I'm not in any way suggesting the media shouldn't have pointed out that those were falsehoods. I'm just suggesting that overall, the media has gone far beyond, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, gone far beyond reporting mere facts. And they have, and the other example is the media are promoting themselves as part of the Trump resistance, not in overt terms, but democracy dies in darkness, the Washington Post's new motto is. And that was no accident that that came up and was part of their promotional, you know, an implicit promotional campaign right after Trump was elected. My point is that the media has tend to become, in my opinion, and the opinion of many, even more partisan than it was seen before. The media is splintering into partisan elements. The media is losing its credibility as a result, and, you know, overall for the nation. And it mirrors the divisiveness in the country, of course. Conservatives read conservative news and liberals read liberal news.
Should the New York Times have come out and used the word lie?
It's interesting. So the executive editor of the New York Times, they used it once or twice since Trump was president.
Right.
And that was very controversial within the newsroom. And Dean Baquet said that we don't use that word much because you have to know intent. I don't have any trouble with the media saying Trump's a liar when he's clearly a liar. That's really not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about overreacting to things Trump does. I'm talking about interjecting opinion into news stories. I'm talking about letting your hair down on Twitter to really go after the president and to let your politics be clear beyond the news story in ways that inform the news story. I'm talking about the media as promoting themselves as part of the resistance. All of those things are part of changing media norms in response to Trump that I don't believe are going to serve the media overall very well.
But, you know, I wonder whether most of these institutions that you talk about, the courts, the media, hadn't trust in those institutions already broken down even before the election.
Yes, and I talk about this at the end. So there's been a generic decline in trust and confidence in American institutions for a while now. I believe, you know, this is speaking at a 40,000-foot level, but I believe that obviously I think that one of the reasons Trump was elected was because of declining trust in American institutions, especially off the coast in this country. So I agree with your point completely, but Trump is accelerating the process. And we're kind of in this downward spiral where these institutions are being attacked like they've never been before by any president. It's really completely unprecedented. And they're reacting to it in a way that is, I think, and naturally, I'm not in any way suggesting that these aren't natural reactions, but I think they're reacting to Trump in ways that are further exacerbating the problem. And meanwhile, so things are getting worse on every dimension.
Let's talk for just a moment about this president and North Korea. Does that situation worry you?
Of course it worries me. Yes.
And what do you see, considering the fact that you say he lacks emotional intelligence, considering the fact that we have learned from different sources that it is only the responsibility of the president to pull the trigger? I mean,
yeah, so it's a very worrisome situation when you have a confrontation with a nuclear power that has been threatening and aggressive, and the president of the United States is someone who is mercurial and uninformed and doesn't tend to exercise good judgment. That is the definition of a very scary situation, and that's the situation we find ourselves in. I take a little bit of comfort. I mean, it's a very scary situation. There's no getting around that. I take a little bit of comfort. I take more than a little comfort from the fact that Mattis in the Defense Department and Kelly as the Chief of Staff are two people who are respected military leaders, one both now retired and having civilian jobs. And they seem to be on the same basic page as Trump on this, or let me put that another way. Trump seems to heed their advice. He has, in many contexts, is even backed down on a couple of issues in deference to Mattis. And so, you know, it's a very fraught situation. It's not at all clear what the right thing to do is, but I don't believe, at least I hope and I believe that Mattis and Kelly will keep the president on a sane path in this context.
Professor Goldsmith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your good questions.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Now, Dan Jones. He's the author of several books on the Middle Ages. His most recent is The Templars, The Rise and Spectacular Fall of God's Holy Warriors. Dan Jones, how great to talk to you again.
Absolutely wonderful to talk to you too.
You know, the Templars have certainly been in pop culture for a long time. I remember, as I'm sure many people do, watching The Da Vinci Code and reading that book and all the mysteries surrounding them. So tell us about the Templars, their rise and spectacular fall, you call it, of God's holy warriors.
Well, you know, the Templars were, To put it simply, a military order in the Middle Ages, which means that they were warriors who'd taken religious oaths. They were set up in the aftermath of the First Crusade, so we're talking about the early 12th century, and for about 200 years they were the most famous military order out of dozens. Now, there were other military orders of equal sort of size and to some degree competence, the Hospitallers, the Teutonic Knights, the Livonian Sword Brothers, you know, you could name a lot of them. But there's only one that we really talk about today. And when I sat down to write my new book and I was looking for a subject I thought that that people would enjoy and that would link together themes from the Middle Ages with themes we're still interested in today, I didn't immediately think that I should write, for example, a book about the Teutonic Knights or the Hospitallers, because none of them have that same resonance that you've referred to, mentioning the Da Vinci Code, as the Templars.
So we have the Templars. They go back to the 12th century. But then apparently they were suppressed for many centuries, and yet they continued to live on. Tell us all about what happened during that period of suppression.
Well, after about 200 years, slightly short of 200 years of existence, during which time the Templars had been at the forefront of the Crusades, fighting in Crusader armies, financing the Crusades, building up a big property empire, the Crusader states, the Christian states in the Middle East, were lost, and the Templars were widely held accountable for that loss. So at the beginning of the 14th century, in the first decade of the 14th century, there was a lot of call for the Templars to be reformed, to be merged with other military orders. Now, parallel to that, they also fell into the gaze of a king of France called Philip IV, Philip the Fair, who had some very practical problems within his realm and some very personal problems within his psychology. Now, to deal with the practical problems first, he was chronically short of money, having waged war against Aragon to his southern borders, against England and against Flanders. He was running a huge budget deficit, we would say today. He had a financial problem in that there was a great shortage of silver. He needed ready money. Now, Philip had taken a few options before he alighted on the Templars. He tried to tax the church. It had taken him into an enormous war with the papacy. he had expelled 100,000 Jews, which was France's entire Jewish population, and confiscated all of their wealth. That wasn't enough. So in 1307, he took aim at the Templars because he saw that they were an extremely rich order, but an organization which was the subject of a lot of public scrutiny and quite a lot of public blame.
How did the Templars get all this money? How did they accrue that?
They were incredibly popular, Diane. You know, from their very beginnings, within a decade or two of their foundation in Jerusalem, people during the crusading era had become captivated by the idea of the Templars, by what they did and what they stood for, which was to say, they defended pilgrims, Christian pilgrims around Jerusalem. They fought in crusader armies. They recruited from the greatest knights of the day. They had this incredibly iconic uniform. The knights wore white with a red cross emblazoned on it. And people loved the idea of the Templars. Now, if they didn't want to join up, what they could do was donate to the order. So you had kings donating huge portions of their kingdom. Huh. You had ordinary people donating whatever they could. A horse, a parcel of land, a coat, you know, right down to the meagrest possessions. And the Templars organized all of that into a huge property empire spanning from Ireland and Britain all the way to Cyprus and the Holy Land. So this generated vast amounts of money, and they're very adept at managing the money too.
And tell us how they even got their name, the Templars.
It's such an evocative name, isn't it? And it comes from their establishment in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif to followers of Islam. But the Christians who had occupied Jerusalem during the First Crusade identified the Temple Mount with the temple that was built by King Solomon, described in the Old Testament in the Book of Kings in vivid, beautiful detail. Now, the Templars were awarded as their global headquarters in Jerusalem the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which they identified with the long-lost Temple of Solomon. And so from that temple came their name, the Poor Knights of the Temple of Solomon, or for short, the Templars.
So here they were, filled with riches. No wonder King Philip wanted to acquire some of what they had. How did he go about doing that?
You're absolutely right. Philip knew exactly how wealthy the Templars were because they owned a lot of property in his kingdom, and they'd been carrying out, they'd been subcontracting the treasury functions of the French crown for 100 years. Huh. He could physically see their wealth because it was all kept in the temple, or a lot of it was kept in the temple in Paris. How he went about it was in the most cynical way imaginable. The previous year, 1306, as I said to you, he'd attacked France's Jews, and he'd sent out secret orders a month before a due date, and all of the Jews in France were rounded up, their property was taken from them, and they were expelled in a very, very fast and efficiently carried out purge. Exactly the same tactics were used in 1307 against the Templars. Secret orders were sent out at the end of September to royal officials all across France, to be opened on the 13th of October, Friday the 13th of October, 1307. At dawn on that day, royal officials all across France went to every single temple house, preceptory, commandery, kind of think about a monastery full of Templar brothers, knocked on the door, revealed these orders, which accused the Templars of grotesque crimes against against morality, against the church, and they were all rounded up, arrested and taken away for imprisonment and torture in one morning.
Wow. And yet they had been so strong. They had been so popular. They even, as you write in the book, had pioneered many modern ways of finance and holding on to those finances. And yet all of that is disrupted on this one day.
Well, isn't that the extraordinary thing? Here you had an organization which was vastly wealthy, wealthier than some kingdoms, which had an extremely highly developed elite military wing, which owned property in many, many kingdoms, which had been granted huge tax breaks by the Pope. And yet, in one morning in the Kingdom of France, they were brought down and they disappeared. Now, when I first came to this writing my book, I found it hard to get my head around. And you know what? Then I thought back to a time in my own lifetime. I was in California in 2008 watching the news when Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns were wound up, right? And it would have seemed unimaginable had you said 2 years previously that one day Lehman Brothers will just vanish and cease to exist. And yet we know this extremely wealthy organization, that happened in our lifetime. And so when you think of it in those terms, the disappearance of the Templars, although carried out in a very different way, because actually lots of members of the Order of the Temple were arrested and charges were brought against them, they were wound up and they effectively ceased to exist on that one morning.
A theme in the book, Dan Jones, seems to be the tension between faith and progress. Talk about that.
I think that's right. I think the Templars were set up in the crucible of the crusading era. And the most enthusiastic point in medieval Christianity's militant period, when Western Christians, by their thousands, were flocking to the Near East and the Middle East to take over, to occupy, to visit, to worship at the most holy sites in Christianity, located in Jerusalem and the surrounding area. I think over the 200 years that then passed, the Templars, in some senses, moved with the times. You know, they developed from an organization set up to guard pilgrims, sworn to vows of chastity and poverty and obedience, and all of their members promised to live like monks. Well, they developed an elite paramilitary wing which fought with the armies of the Crusades. They developed very, very sophisticated financial services, banking services, which by the standards of the day were cutting edge. But at the same time, as they developed, you know, this huge property empire and so on, as they developed, they moved further and further away from their original purpose. So the symbol of the Templars, which was there on the master's seal, which he used to authenticate documents, was of two brothers sharing a single horse. This idea of poverty lay at the heart of the order. Yet when you come to, for example, the Fifth Crusade at the beginning of the 13th century, by which time the Order of the Temple was about 100 years old, there had come along the rise of mendicant orders like friars, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, who followed St. Francis of Assisi, who were living by much stricter vows of poverty, who were walking barefoot, dressed in sackcloth, abjuring all possessions. And the contrast then between these new, more severe orders of religious devotion and the Templars, who by that stage were institutionally extremely wealthy, very grand, wore these uniforms, only recruited knights from families of high status. Times had changed, and the Templars appeared to have moved further and further from their original purpose, which was why, by the early 14th century, when the King of France decided to attack them, he saw the best way to do it was to point to these inconsistencies between the Temple as an organization and their, what we'd now call their brand values, their core ideals to which all their members had sworn oaths of obedience.
And so you say the French king actually used medieval fake news to indict these Templars and to accuse them of all sorts of things, including blasphemy.
Absolutely. You know, the reading through the documents pertaining to the Templars' downfall, the records of the trial, the accusations leveled against them, it's quite chilling because it was so cynical. The accusations brought against them, as you say, they were a form of medieval fake news. It was they were in a sense ludicrous. The Templars were accused of blasphemy, of heresy, of spitting on the cross, of trampling on the image of Jesus Christ, of sexual misdeeds, of homosexual relations between members, of grotesque, perverted induction ceremonies, of worshipping false idols. Every single button that could be pressed in the medieval religious mindset to shock and to appall was pressed. And academics who studied this for many, many years, even more years than I have, will almost universally agree that all of these charges were at best, massively trumped up and probably just completely false. And yet, because they were so salacious, because they were so disgusting and grotesque, they took root and people wanted to believe them. And the Templars found it very, very difficult to fight back against the sheer weight of accusation that was levelled against them.
And there is one scene in the Da Vinci Code where one of the Templars commits self-flagellation to such an extent that people in the audience are truly squirming. Was that a part of their ritual?
I think a lot of the details that were brought into the Da Vinci Code to portray the Templars were brilliantly but slightly cynically distorted from the original. And in fact, the sort of the taste for self-flagellation and mortification of the flesh belonged much more to the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the people who were on the other side, who were appointed as the inquisitors and the torturers of the Templars. And it was they really who had the taste for the sort of mortification of the flesh. Now, that's not to say that the Templars had an easy life. You know, every brother who swore the oath of membership of the Templars was warned specifically at his induction ceremony that to join the Templars was to lead a miserable life. It was to embrace poverty. It was to forget all worldly possessions. It was to take a very severe vow of chastity. And the punishments for disobedience within the Order of the Temple were likewise severe. A brother who said so much as that he didn't want to be a member of the Order on two occasions would be subject to penance, which could include beating in front of all the rest of his brothers, which could involve being forced to eat his food from the floor with the dogs for a year and a day. The Temple was not an easy ride. That said, I think the way that the Templars have been portrayed in popular culture, and it's not just the Da Vinci Code and Dan Brown, this goes back at least to Sir Walter Scott and Ivanhoe, if not before. The way that the Templars have been portrayed has gleefully embraced the some of the aspect, the most salacious aspects of the charges that were brought against them in the 14th century.
But here is the part I don't understand. You talked earlier about their accumulation of great wealth, their understanding of finance. What did they do with all that money before the King of France took it away from them?
Well, there's the big question, and that's the question that a lot of people asked at the time. You know, what are the Templars doing with all this wealth? Well, the simplest answer is that they were fighting. And as we know from recent political and military experience, fighting foreign wars in the Middle East costs a great deal of money. It always has. It always will. And the Templars were set up structurally and organizationally to have a relatively small number of fighting men based in the Middle East, mainly Syria, Egypt, Palestine, some others based in Spain and Portugal, which was also an arena of crusading at the time. But the majority of the organization was a wealth-creating structure. It farmed land, it traded in commodities, and the profits that were made from those commercial activities were funneled directly to the fighting effort. Now, because for most of the crusading period, the Christians in the Middle East were effectively fighting a rearguard campaign. They were constantly under attack, and they were always in need of reinforcements from outside. It's a very expensive business. That said, the Templars were certainly doing the best they could and doing quite impressive work while they were out in the Middle East. They built some of the most enormous and impressive fortresses in Greater Syria, places like Chateau Pellerin, now known as Atlit, which is probably comparable in modern terms with the Green Zone that the United States built in Baghdad at the height of the Iraq War. It was an unbelievable military complex, so big that it could house thousands of troops. It could feed thousands of people. It could hold thousands of horses. The staircases were built so knights could ride their horses around the castle. It had a deep water harbour. You know, we're talking about serious military hardware that people couldn't believe that the Templars were able to build, no matter what knowledge there was of their wealth at the time.
Now, we can't talk about the Templars without mentioning former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon. Talk about that connection.
Well, you know what? I was reading Josh Green's excellent book about President Trump and Steve Bannon, which came out a couple of months ago. And there was a detail that obviously leapt out at me, which was a description Josh Green included in his book of intellectual influences that Steve Bannon had when he was a younger man, reading a lot of history. And one of the writers that Bannon alighted upon, and which apparently informed a great deal of his worldview as a younger man, were the writings of René Guénon, a French mystical writer of the earlier 20th century, who dated the demise of Western civilization to 1312 and the rolling up of the Order of the Temple, and thought that this was the moment at which the state had become much too powerful. This was also the moment at which an organization which had linked the knowledge and understanding and learnings of the East with the polities and the civilization and the culture of the West had been cynically destroyed in an attack made by the international church and by the growing French state. And he thought that this was the moment at which civilization began to decay. And I found that idea so absolutely delicious that the man who was at the time President Trump's chief strategist was in some way influenced by thinking that it all began with the fall of the Templars.
And are you surprised that in this day and age, linking that kind of history to today's political era comes into the conversation?
I'm somewhat biased, Diane, in that I think the Middle Ages are relevant to absolutely everything, and I recognise that I'm trying to convert people to that point of view, but I'm particularly writing this book about the Templars. I was surprised by how many echoes there are today of this sort of history. You know, a story that's about a war that seems to be unending in the Middle East between Sunni and Shia Islam, with Western military intervention going badly wrong. A story that's about global finance. A story that's about organizations which become more powerful than states and have these enormous tax breaks and commercial empires which seem to sort of leak across what we'd now call national borders. A story that's about propaganda, the power of political nightmare, of fake news. A story that's about the fusing together of legends and myth with political and military and religious history. You know, all of these things just seemed so timely as well as timeless when I was writing. And I never want to, being serious, overstate the parallels between history 800 years ago and current affairs today. But sometimes it's just too close to ignore.
Do you think any of those Templars or the ones who came after them, do you think those organizations continue to survive in the 20th century?
I think that there are lots of revivals of Templar-like organizations. Even there are organizations that call themselves the Templars, you know. And it ranges from the benign, you know, there are Christian charities who identify with the original aims of the Order of the Temple, which is to protect Christians. There are organizations which are very much not benign. There are lots of sort of neo-fascists in Europe at the moment who have adopted Templar symbolism. There is in Mexico a drug cartel which calls itself Los Caballeros Templarios, the Knights Templar, and which explicitly models itself on the original Templars and adopts their symbolism and their imagery. Do the Templars, as they existed in the Middle Ages, exist today? No, I adamantly don't believe that, and I don't believe there's a sort of global conspiracy in which the Illuminati have, you know, have managed to keep the Templars alive, and they defend the secrets of the church, or what, you know, any of those conspiracy theories that abound in the popular imagination on the internet. I don't think any of them are demonstrably true, even though a lot of them are a great deal of fun. However, I do think that people today look to the Templars as a symbol of a whole range of things that are important and germane to society today, ranging from, you know, the genuinely good charitable ideals to genuinely bad, racist and aggressive and divisive ideologies.
Well, Dan Jones, once again, in your new book, The Templars, you inform us that indeed history does live on. I'm so delighted to have had the chance to talk with you. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you for your wonderful questions, as always. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. Our engineer is Timothy Olmsted. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman, with help this week from Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.